Hello and welcome to Profiles. I'm Will Murphy, and today we have the opportunity to meet with Dr. William Schultz, the Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Now let's begin this program by finding out a little bit about how you came to your position and your involvement in human rights struggles. First of all, you come to this position through the Unitarian Universalist Church, in a way.
Yes, that's right. I was trained as a Unitarian Universalist minister at the University of Chicago and then served the Unitarian Universalist denomination, first as Director of Social Justice, then as Executive Vice President, and finally for the last 8 years, from 1985 to 93, as President of the denomination. And it was after that service that Amnesty International, which was looking at the time for a new executive director, selected me, and I was fortunate that they did so. They were looking for someone who had been involved in international issues and social justice issues, and of course the Unitarian Universalist churches are ones that have always believed that social justice is an integral part of the religious life of a church and institution like that, and I had been deeply involved in many social justice issues over the years, and I also knew a little something about running a large, complex, nonprofit organization. I think it was that combination that attracted Amnesty International.
Now, can you point to something in your upbringing, in your development, that generates this interest in justice issues?
Well, of course, I was raised, as many baby boomers were, during the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War era. All of that was very much a part of my consciousness as I went to junior high and high school and college. Perhaps the most formative event directly relevant to my human rights work, however, it took place when I was a junior and senior at Oberlin College and was serving as a student minister at a little Unitarian Universalist congregation in a little town in Ohio by the name of Kent, Ohio. And it just so happened that that was at the very time in May of 1970 that the Kent State shootings took place, in which the National Guard fired upon and killed four and injured many more students who were protesting against the Vietnam War. I think that was a seminal event for me, a recognition very firsthand, almost right before my eyes, that sometimes even democratic governments like we have here in the United States can unjustifiably turn upon their citizens even when those citizens are not engaged in violent acts, as the students were not. And that, I think, crystallized a recognition of what had been somewhat abstract because, of course, even during the civil rights era, I, having grown up in Pittsburgh, was not directly involved as a teenager in the civil rights movement in the South. I think that crystallized in a very concrete and important way for me a fundamental principle that eventually led to my larger social justice commitments and more specifically to my work to protect political minorities and other types of dissidents and minorities around the world.
Now, in your work, both with the church and with Amnesty International, are there particular issues that you are focused on and interested in and motivated by?
Yes, indeed, the whole range of them. I think that certainly the fundamental issue of torture and the infliction of pain upon people for gratuitous purposes is at the heart of what Amnesty International does. And I think it's also something that can't help but move any of us who work in this business, who meet people who have been the victims of torture and other forms of abuse and violence. And indeed, one of the most inspiring aspects of my work is to meet people who have experienced that and yet have somehow emerged from it with a wholeness of spirit, with a willingness to go on in life. It's hard for me personally to imagine how I would react to some of the experiences that I've heard about over the years. But people have an amazingly resilient spirit and are able to heal again, or at least to integrate those terrible experiences into their lives and use them as a reason to go forward. So that whole area of the infliction of pain, both physical and psychological, is a very, very important one for our work. And, of course, more recently, the work about post-9/11 human rights violations both here and around the world has preoccupied Amnesty.
Now, we might back up here just for a moment and talk about the organization and its sort of modus operandi.
Mm-hmm.
explain for our listeners what the premise is behind Amnesty International and how it works to affect social change around the world.
The fundamental premise behind Amnesty is that citizens, average folks like you and me from all around the world, by bearing witness to human rights violations, by putting that small measure of their weight on the side of justice, can actually, not in all circumstances, but in many of them, make a very profound difference. Amnesty was founded in 1961 in Great Britain when a British barrister named Peter Benenson read of two college students in Portugal, which was at the time, 1961, under a military dictatorship. Two college students who'd been tossed into jail for no greater crime than raising their glasses of beer in a toast to freedom in a college pub. And Benenson editorialized in a London newspaper, invited people to join him in writing polite letters to the Portuguese government asking for the release of those students. And that was the genesis, the germ, the seed of the idea that sometimes merely by bearing witness, folks from Indiana can have a profound impact on what's happening in Lagos, Nigeria, or Jakarta, Indonesia. That was the beginning of Amnesty, the notion that what we call prisoners of conscience, people who are imprisoned or abused or tortured for their nonviolent political or religious beliefs or their sexual orientation or because they're reporters trying to get the truth out, that sometimes mass citizen witness to that can have an impact. And we estimate that we've helped free at least 42,000 prisoners of conscience since we were founded. Now, since then, of course, Amnesty has gone on to work in many other areas, not just prisoners of conscience. And most recently, we're even beginning to work in the area of economic and social rights, not just the traditional civil and political rights of free speech and free trial, fair trials and an end to torture and so on. But that still is at the heart of Amnesty's work, the notion that citizens, that the culture of respect for human rights around the world is built by changing the minds of citizens one by one and by bringing to bear the power of that citizen witness upon abusive forces around the world.
What do you say to those who might have a skeptical view of the organization, saying college kids may feel good about getting together and writing letters to the heads of countries around the world, vowing or voicing their displeasure about practices of torture, etc. But really, these guys are tough guys, and they're not going to listen to a bunch of college students from Oberlin or some other kind of college in the U.S.
It's true that not all tyrants will listen to college students or anyone else, but a surprisingly large percentage of them will, in part because most governments today want to be understood as respected members of the international community. Virtually all governments, maybe North Korea is an exception, but even the most repressive governments today, virtually all of them at least give lip service to the rhetoric of human rights. When they are targeted, not just by college students, but by large numbers of people around the world, and let's remember that Amnesty is not just a United States organization by any means. We have 1.7 million members in more than 80 countries around the world. When a regime starts getting communications from literally thousands and thousands of people, not just from the United States, but from all over the world, raising the visibility of their violations and impressing upon them the fact that they can't get away with these things in secret, that begins to get their attention. Not everyone, as I say, but a much larger percentage than one might think. And then when you add to that the pressure that college students or any U.S. citizen can bring to bear upon the U.S. Congress to ask the Congress and the administration to use its leverage with that government, when you think about the pressure that college students often bring to bear upon corporations to ask those corporations to reform their own practices and to utilize whatever leverage those corporations may have in the countries where they're invested that are abusing human rights, well, there are a whole series of ways in which any of us can have an impact on the world far, far away from us geographically, but in fact very close to us in terms of our hearts and in terms of the actual practical impact that human rights violations have upon us here at home.
Can you point to a few sort of outstanding cases where letter writing campaigns have been successful?
Well, yes, indeed. There are many of them. They range from the so-called father of Chinese democracy, Wei Jingsheng, who was freed a few years ago after 17 years in prison, years in which Amnesty International members had never forgotten him, had continued to wage a campaign on his behalf, to more anonymous prisoners, some 400 prisoners of conscience released in Morocco just a year or so ago, as a result in large measure of the kind of pressure that Amnesty International can bring. They range to the case of Saad Ibrahim, who is probably the greatest champion of democracy in Egypt, who was imprisoned by the Egyptian government, brought to trial by the Egyptian government, essentially because he had criticized corruption in Egyptian elections. Amnesty International mobilized around his case, and he was eventually released by the courts. Gay and lesbian people in Egypt who were taken into custody solely for their sexual orientation. Again, Amnesty International and many of the international gay and lesbian organizations mobilized around those cases, and eventually many of those were released. So there have been many, many successes in Amnesty's history.
How does your organization determine sort of which causes and which individuals to focus on and campaign for?
Well, of course, it's always a difficult decision. There are, of course, at any one time, tens of thousands of people in need of Amnesty's assistance, although I'm pleased to say that the number of prisoners of conscience, per se, has decreased over the last few years as democratization has spread around the globe. Amnesty has researchers who are based in London and elsewhere around the world who are experts on some 140 countries that we monitor at any one time. Those are the people who try to identify the cases, and particularly cases where the kind of public opinion that I've just described to you may indeed have an impact. And they're the ones, in general, who select the cases and then put information out about those cases to the 1.7 million Amnesty members around the world. We try to make our decisions based, of course, on need, but also on effectiveness. And it's something of a subjective judgment. But as I say, in most cases, we're able to have some kind of impact.
Now, you say that the organization was formed about 42 years ago. You've been affiliated with it for about 10 years as the executive director, USA. When did you first become aware of Amnesty International? I assume that and I say this as a fellow baby boomer, in the 1960s, it wasn't a really high-profile organization. But
no,
that's changed.
Amnesty gained wide international attention in 1977 when it received the Nobel Peace Prize. But here in the United States, it was still not well-known, not widely known, until actually the late 1980s when a series of concerts, both domestically and international, took place. This was under my predecessor, Jack Healey. A series of concerts with renowned stars such as Bruce Springsteen and Sting and Peter Gabriel. And that really is what caused a boom in Amnesty membership here in the United States and put Amnesty on the map. Since then, we have grown to about 320,000 members here in the United States today. I was aware of Amnesty, of course, long before I came to Amnesty and was affiliated with it, but like so many people, I supported it fairly passively. I would make a contribution, certainly, but I was not actively involved because of my commitment to the Unitarian Universalist congregations. But the fact is that we have a core of at least 50,000 activists among our members who are involved day in and day out in our local community groups, in our student groups, in our networks of education professionals, health professionals, lawyers, and so on. And they're the ones who do the active work day in and day out that makes a difference in so many people's lives.
Looking at your biography, you've been to a lot of very unpleasant places in the world and seen some very unpleasant things. How do you maintain the commitment and the energy to sustain the drive, so to speak, having seen the kind of repression and torture that you've been witness to?
Well, partly it's because of what I mentioned before, the fact that I have had the privilege of meeting people who have been victims of these kinds of oppressive torturous acts and have emerged from them whole. And often when I meet such people, I say to myself, you know, all that I'm doing is going into this country, going into the prison, but I can walk right out again. I can then talk to the media, I can talk to the government, I can talk to citizens back in the United States. I can do something about this, and then I can go back to my pleasant middle-class life. These folks have not had that privilege, and when they finally are freed from whatever kind of persecution or barbaric behavior they've been subjected to, the least that I can do in the face of their willingness to tell their stories, to try to help other people, the least that I can do is to maintain my own equilibrium, my spirit, and do what I can to provide a platform for them and to provide a mechanism whereby more and more citizens can join in helping people like that. I suppose in some measure it's a bit of a religious discipline, but it certainly doesn't do any victim any good for me to allow myself to sink into a morass of despond or despair and to not realize that every day is a precious gift for every single one of us, no matter our circumstances. And our job as responsible citizens of the world, and certainly for religious people, our job as religious people is to do what little we can to make those gifts available to a larger and larger number of people. And those who are deprived of access to those gifts, well, those are top on my list of people who I want to help.
You made a brief reference there to faith in your comments there. Is this effort that you undertake day in, day out, an outgrowth of your work with the church? Is it an act of faith for you?
There's certainly a degree of faith. Of course, Amnesty International is a wholly secular organization with people who would have no truck whatsoever with religion, and that is just fine as well. But of course, for me, there is always a degree of faith involved in the conviction that in the long run, as Theodore Parker, a great Unitarian minister, put it, in the long run, the arc of the universe bends toward justice, a very nice phrase, I think. And what he meant by that is that despite the setbacks that we all experience every day, every year in the struggle for justice, over the long haul, the universe does move, or our society at least, does move in a direction that incorporates more and more respect for fundamental human dignity and human rights. And I think that if you look at human history in that term and in those terms and recognize that it's only been within the last 50 or so years that we've had the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that we've even recognized the concept of universal rights that every human being from every nation may claim. It's only been within the last 50 or 60 years that we've had the notion growing out of the Nuremberg trials of international justice, most recently embodied in the form of the new International Criminal Court. It's only been within the last 120 or 130 years that slavery has been widely outlawed and understood to be an utterly barbaric and unacceptable practice, even though, unfortunately, of course, it remains in a few isolated places around the world. These are evidences that the arc of the universe bends toward justice, but it only bends in that direction if there are citizens mobilized to make it bend. It doesn't just happen automatically. I don't believe that our fates are in the hands of history or of God and that human beings simply sit back and enjoy the ride. I think we shape the future, we shape history, and that's part of what Amnesty International tries to do.
I don't know if you'd agree with this, but my perception, having seen again the protests of the civil rights era and looking at the world around me now, it seems like protest has taken a different sort of it's evolved somehow. That is to say, once upon a time, you got your protest sign and you went out on the streets and you marched and then you went back to your life. And now, whether it's buying the politically correct coffee at Starbucks or making the politically correct investment in your portfolio, or writing letters through Amnesty International, people are incorporating protest as a part of their everyday life, the way they live.
Well, I hope you're right about that. Certainly, there are large numbers of people who are doing that. I guess I'm not quite as sanguine about whether or not that kind of an attitude towards life is pervasive in the large majority of Americans. I think there's still a lot of indifference and lack of consciousness about the world around us, reflected solely in the fact that we have such low percentages of people who even bother to vote in elections. I think it's a very important thing, and one of the reasons I'm so proud of Amnesty International is that we have such a large student population. We have more than 1,600 high school and college chapters of Amnesty International. Of all the social justice organizations in the United States, we're certainly one of the few that has such a large youth population. And we work hard to nurture and maintain our student populations, not only because they're among the most vibrant of all, but also because we know that that's the way in which we're going to seed a new generation of activists to make sure that more and more people do live the kind of lives that you've eloquently just described.
Why do you suppose it is that your organization does have such appeal for a younger audience?
Well, I think there are several things. One is we try very hard to keep that human face on human rights violations. I think that it was actually Joseph Stalin who said that the death of a million people is a statistic. The death of one person is a tragedy. And it's very difficult for any of us to respond just to numbers. It's far easier when you learn about a young woman who has been killed or tortured because of her parents' political activity, for example, a young person who may be interested in many of the same musicians or the same movies or have the same kind of aspirations for her educational or professional future that our own young people do. Putting that human face is very important, but also I think showing that you actually can make a difference and that you're making a difference in an ethical cause. This is not just a matter of earning more money or getting more prestige or more attention. This is actually a matter of saving human lives. It's about the most serious kind of work that can be done, and yet what we try to do is to add a note of larger appreciation. That's why we use the entertainment industry. We work with Hollywood. We work with musicians. We work with artists of all kinds to get this message across, because though it is serious business, we want to say that it's also life-affirming business, that it is not just a matter of gravitas and despair. It's also a matter of saying, look, we can change the world. We can make a difference, and you can do that on a one-by-one, case-by-case basis.
Do you see young people more or less engaged, more or less optimistic about their ability to change things than they were when you were growing up?
Well, it's hard to make generalizations like that. What I certainly can say is that travel across this country and I speak on college or university campuses once or twice a month every single year, I meet an outpouring of interest in our work and a tremendous desire to be a part of this. Now, that's certainly not the case with all students, as it's not by any means the case with all U.S. citizens. But there is, it doesn't take a majority to change the world. One of the things that I like to remember is that during the Vietnam War, a little book came out called The Trim Tab Factor. The Trim Tab is the little doohickey on the rudder of a boat that determines the direction of the rudder in order that the rudder can in turn determine the direction of the boat itself. And the point of this little book was that it doesn't take a majority to change the direction of a country. It takes a determined, dedicated, well-educated, well-informed, and articulate minority to turn that rudder so that in turn the rudder will turn the direction of the society, of the boat itself. The fact is that even on the day that the U.S. withdrew from Vietnam, a majority of Americans still said that they supported U.S. intervention in Vietnam. At no point in U.S. history did a majority of Americans ever oppose U.S. action in Vietnam, and yet the U.S. eventually withdrew from Vietnam. The same is true of the civil rights movement. At the civil rights movement, at its greatest triumph, if you had taken a poll, particularly in the southern states, and asked them whether they supported the changes that were going to take place there, I feel quite confident that a vast majority of whites and even a certain number of blacks would have opposed that. But nonetheless, those changes took place. It takes that dedicated minority, and that's what we try to cultivate in Amnesty International.
in case you just joined us, this is Profiles, and our guest is Dr. William Schultz, the Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. Now let's take a break. As you know, we offer a little musical selection that we ask our guests to come up with. And Dr. Schultz, what would you like us to play?
Well, the informal anthem of the human rights movement is Bob Marley's Get Up, Stand Up for Human Rights. It's an old song, a popular one, but it is certainly one that crystallizes, as did Bob Marley himself during his lifetime, a commitment to what we've been talking about.
How did that get appropriated by Amnesty International as its sort of theme?
Well, as I say, in the late 1980s, Amnesty International had a very strong connection with the musical entertainment industry. Bob Marley was one of those people. Bob Marley, of course, from Jamaica, very conscious of the way in which human rights were changing the face of not just his own country, but throughout the Latin American region. The way in which human rights were important for indigenous people, for people of color around the world, and this song that he composed was very much a part of that effort.
Now let's turn to the books that you've written. In addition to your many other activities and endeavors, you're an author. In 2001, you published In Our Own Best Interest, How Defending Human Rights Benefits Us All. What was the genesis behind that? What was the catalyst behind that book? And what's the premise? That is to say, how does human rights benefit us all?
The catalyst, actually, was an interview that I did with a Knoxville radio station in which we had been discussing human rights violations around the world. And the moderator said to me, you know, Dr. Schultz, I'm sure that all of us here in East Tennessee agree with you about how terrible these things are going on in Burundi and Bosnia and Burma. But tell me now, if I'm earning a living, barely scratching out a living in the hills of East Tennessee, worried about paying the mortgage or maybe sending my kid away to college, what difference do all of these terrible things happening so far away, what difference do they make to my life? And I thought it was an excellent question. We usually talk about human rights in moral terms. We talk about how it is ethically wrong to torture somebody. To deny them a fair trial. But in fact, while that is of course true, it's also true that there are a whole series of practical consequences that impact that person, even in East Tennessee, when human rights are violated around the world. Actually, if you think about it, the countries in which U.S. military servicemen and women, many of whom may well be drawn from the hill country of East Tennessee, have had to go into action over the last 15 years, Somalia, Haiti, Iraq, Afghanistan. These are all countries which have been renowned for the denial of basic human rights. As countries evolve into human rights respecting democracies, they tend to settle their disputes nonviolently. That's, of course, not always the case. But it is more often the case than when countries are mired in cultures of disrespect for human rights. So one of the most fundamental reasons that it's important to protect human rights is in order to keep our young military men and women safe. And there are many, many other ways in which the violation of human rights far away can have dire consequences for us here at home. Our economy is dependent upon stability around the world. And human rights almost inevitably leads to instability. Or here's an example that I like to give because it's so direct. Russian prison cells are notorious for the fact that they are hellholes of miasmas, of disease spreading without even the most elementary right to health care provided to Russian prisoners. Now, what could those hellholes in Moscow and other places in the former Soviet Union possibly have to do with us here in the United States? Well, what they have to do with us very directly is that a strain of tuberculosis arose out of Russian prisons because of the denial of the basic human right to health care. And thanks to trade and travel, that same strain spread around the world until today. It's found in the United States. HIV/AIDS itself, though regardless of where it originated, certainly spread in large measure out of Africa because of human rights violations committed by Idi Amin in Uganda, in which he in effect destroyed the medical system there at exactly the crucial time when that disease was gaining a foothold. These are just some examples of the ways in which human rights violations, even in places far, far away, can come back to haunt us here in the United States. And that's what that first book was about, explaining that defending human rights actually is not just something we do for moral or ethical reasons, but we do it because it's in our own best interests.
Some would say that American foreign policy oftentimes has a tendency to foster these sorts of problems, and they'd point to the support of Saddam Hussein before he became our enemy.
Yes.
Or support of Shah of Iran. Is Amnesty involved in sort of proactive efforts to guide U.S. policy away from folks who are judged to be dictatorial and oppressive?
Absolutely, absolutely. What you've said is a telling lesson that the United States seems rarely to learn, and that is that when we support those, when we align ourselves with those, and particularly when we supply military equipment and weapons to those who are themselves committing human rights violations, it often comes back to haunt us. You know, in fact, during the 1980s, when the Soviet Union had invaded Afghanistan, the United States aligned itself with General Zia of Pakistan, aligned itself with many of the forces that were resisting the Soviet Union, but failed to require of those people any adherence to basic human rights standards. And the results of that alignment and the results of the more than $3 billion worth of military and other kind of assistance that we provided to Zia and his allies was that among other factions that grew up were the Taliban. We, in effect, nurtured the roots of the Taliban itself. And, of course, as we now well know, the Taliban then provided sanctuary to al-Qaeda, and we know the consequences of that. And the same is true, as you've mentioned, of Iraq, when throughout the 1980s, Iraq was a principal ally of the United States. And Saddam Hussein, in his fight with Iran, which, of course, was an enemy of the U.S. as having taken our embassy officials prisoner, we ignored Saddam Hussein's horrific human rights violations, a record that Amnesty International had been reporting on since Saddam's rise to power. And, of course, that, too, came back to haunt us. The story is the same over and over again. And one of the reasons that today we are concerned about the implications of the war on terror in other countries is that it appears as if the United States is giving a wink and a nod to many of those countries which are using the war on terror as an excuse to crack down on their own minorities and on those who disagree with the prevailing views of the government. China is one example where it is persecuting Muslims, Uyghur Muslims in the western provinces, people who are for the most part operating in a nonviolent fashion, labeling the Chinese label them terrorists and say that they are simply doing what President Bush asks them to do. And in this case, what they're doing is repressing this particular minority in their own country. We need to learn that lesson. It's a hard one, but it's an important one to learn.
Some would argue that one of those countries that's making the argument against human rights in the fight to oppose terrorism is the United States itself. Does Amnesty take a position on the policies of the American administration?
Absolutely. And indeed, what my latest book is about, in large measure, is a critique of that. The fact is that the United States is now itself involved in a whole series of very profound human rights violations, which don't stand us well in the struggle to convince the world that the war on terror is not, in fact, a war against Islam, but is, in fact, a war in defense of the rule of law, in defense of freedom, in defense of American values, and in defense of human rights. Well, if that's true, then we ought to be the primary exemplars of respect for human rights. But in the case, for example, of the prisoners being held at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, we are shredding the Geneva Conventions by unilaterally labeling those prisoners unlawful combatants instead of doing what the conventions require, which is to have an independent, competent tribunal make the determination as to whether those prisoners are prisoners of war or something else, like unlawful combatants. What we have then is 650 prisoners being held in incommunicado, indefinite detention without any access to lawyers or courts or any ability to prove themselves innocent, even though we know that some 68 of them have already been released at the whim of the United States. Similarly, two U.S. citizens, Jose Padilla and Yasser Hamdi, are being held in military brigs and being denied either knowledge of why they're being held, what charges are pending against them. They've not been told that, and they're being denied access to a lawyer. Those are two of the most fundamental rights, not only in the U.S. Constitution, but in the panoply of rights guaranteed at the universal level, at the international level. There are also reports in the New York Times and the Washington Post that the United States is torturing prisoners at Bagram Air Force Base and is turning over prisoners to countries like Syria and Morocco and Jordan, which are not hesitant themselves to do torture of prisoners in the process of trying to gain information from them. We know that racial profiling has gone on in the case of many Muslim residents. After 9/11, some 1,200 Muslim residents were taken into custody by the U.S. for no other reason but that they were Muslim. Not a single one of them was charged with any crime connected to terrorism. But the result of their having been taken into custody and shuttled around the country, denied access to translators, denied access to lawyers, denied access to their families, was that we ended up alienating not only 1,200 largely Muslim residents, but the thousands and thousands of others in their families and communities around the world. It's no wonder that the United States, which on September 12, 2001, had immense sympathy and respect from the rest of the world, has seen its image and the positive feelings plummet in virtually every country around the world, including our strongest allies like Great Britain, where, as we've seen, there have been tremendous demonstrations taking place against President Bush's visit.
Now, the book you referenced here, your latest book, Tainted Legacy, 9/11 and the Ruin of Human Rights, perhaps in place of another musical selection, we might impose upon you to read from that.
Yes, I'd be very glad to read a brief passage from that. He wore a firefighter's coat and a respirator hung around his neck, but unlike other firefighters rushing toward the World Trade Center on September 11, 2001, Shahram Hashimi had no helmet or boots. That is because he was in fact not a professional firefighter, but a college student from Iran on his way to his job as an intern at the Bank of New York on Wall Street. Thousands of people were running away from the blast, but some people, firefighters and police, were heading toward it. That inspired Hashimi to join them, to try to help. He went to work joining other civilians in teams, a volunteer fire brigade sent to Ground Zero to fight the fires and look for survivors. Later, he would carry water in buckets to the professionals who were struggling with the enormous blaze. Several times, he came close to being killed. And finally, when the 47-story building at No. 7 collapsed, he became trapped inside, disoriented. Eventually, he was spotted by a mobile triage unit and evacuated by ferry to a hospital. A little more than a year after he became a hero, Shahram Hashimi was required by the Immigration and Naturalization Service to report to its office to be photographed and fingerprinted. It is not that Hashimi had done anything wrong. His visa was perfectly in order. But he is an Iranian, one of thousands of men from 20 selected countries, 19 of them predominantly Muslim, whom the United States now wants to register and fingerprint en masse. Hashimi, who had been in the United States for 4 years already, was chagrined, humiliated. He couldn't sleep. "I am not afraid of fingerprint," he said, "but the foreign students being educated here, like me, are the best potential allies for the United States when we go back to our native countries. We have seen this great democratic system. But this act of registration just typecasts us in a way that is degrading. If we are to defeat terrorism, we must not typecast Muslim students in such a way."
That was William Schultz reading from his book, Tainted Legacy, 9/11 and the Ruin of Human Rights. And Dr. Schultz is the executive director of Amnesty International USA and our guest on Profiles this evening. As you look around the map of the world, two questions. Where are the real hot spots in terms of regimes that are problematic and causing problems and are the target of campaigns? And is there anywhere in the world where oppression, torture, that sort of thing isn't a problem? Are there governments that actually don't conduct themselves in this way?
Well, to answer your second question first, Amnesty has identified torture or at least cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment in more than 120-some countries around the world. So unfortunately, it is a widespread practice, though, of course, there are countries, particularly European countries, which have abjured torture, at least in the large majority of cases. I think that perhaps the only country that has never been named by Amnesty for a human rights violation is Iceland. But the truth is that these violations are unfortunately widespread. There is progress being made. I alluded earlier to growing democratization around the world. Certainly in Latin America, we have seen tremendous progress towards an increase in democracy. We're seeing more and more accountability for human rights crimes being demanded of those who have committed those kinds of crimes, as truth commissions such as the one prototypically that was in place under Bishop Tutu in South Africa operated. And that's, of course, an important development, as is the creation of the International Criminal Court. So we certainly see progress. The Internet and electronic communications have helped the human rights movement immensely because it has allowed us to mobilize people quickly. It's allowed us to pass information into formerly closed societies about human rights so that people can learn about their rights and claim them. It's allowed us to learn about human rights violations even in the most remote corners of the globe and to do so almost instantaneously. At the same time, you asked where some of the most serious human rights violations are taking place. And, of course, there are ongoing examples of human rights violations in virtually every continent. We look, for example, at China, where we continue to see some 300,000 people in prison without trial and where the use of torture against Tibetan Buddhists and Uyghur Muslims and unofficial Catholic priests and Protestant ministers, that is, priests and ministers who are not affiliated with the official churches in that particular country, that practice is endemic throughout China. We look at the Congo, where, in fact, we see ongoing massacres, rapes of women, the enforcement, forcing of children into military units, horrific human rights violations continuing to go on in the Democratic Republic of Congo and receiving very little attention from the world community, as so much energy is focused on Iraq and the Middle East. And speaking of the Middle East, of course, there are ongoing human rights violations taking place there. Israel is responsible for a whole series of very unfortunate human rights violations against the Palestinian population. And, of course, the Palestinians, in the form of suicide bombers, are inflicting horrific human rights violations themselves upon the Israeli population. There are many other instances I could name. In Burma, while there had appeared to be some progress being made toward democracy, the great champion of democracy there, Aung San Suu Kyi, is under virtual house arrest. In Zimbabwe, where Robert Mugabe had been hailed for many years as a great Democrat and a champion of the transformation of that society from white-dominated Rhodesia into a new and free society, has in fact reversed course and cracked down among the most repressive ways of any government in the world. And I could go on and on, but those are at least some of the places that we try to monitor regularly.
What do you say to those folks who say that the whole prospect of suicide bombings and this nebulous sort of terrorist threat that's out there before the world can only be combated with sort of force and a certain amount of threat and violence?
Well, it's important to say that to be an advocate for human rights is not necessarily to be a pacifist. There are legitimate uses of force. There is no reason why a government can't use force in order to protect its people. And in some cases, force is probably the only way to protect people from things like suicide bombers or other types of terrorist activity. The question is whether or not force alone is enough to stop terrorism, and I think that it's quite clear that it is not. We are never going to be able to anticipate every single terrorist act, but the reality is that the number of active terrorists in the world is relatively small. Terrorists can only succeed, they can only operate, however, if they have the support of tens of thousands, maybe even millions of other people who, while they are not themselves active terrorists, are providing sanctuary to terrorists, providing sympathy to them, providing financial support, providing a ready pool of recruits for the next generation of terrorists. And it's that larger group of people, that terrorist retinue, if you will, whom those of us who want to defeat terrorism need to convince to opt not for support of terrorism, but to opt in favor of freedom and human rights and democratic values. The only way to convince those people to do that is to convince them that the war on terror, that the destruction of terrorists, is in fact a legitimate undertaking by a group of governments that in fact support human rights, that are committed to see that there is economic equity in the world, that are prepared to introduce legitimate forms of democracy, that are prepared to support international human rights institutions, that are prepared to listen respectfully to the voices of other countries around the world. And in so many ways, since 9/11, the United States has done just the opposite of that, has tried to force its will upon the world, has thumbed its nose at international institutions, international treaties, at the opinion of other countries, has waged a war which can far too easily be interpreted by Muslim populations as a war against Islam, even though I'm sure that's not what is in President Bush's heart. But the policies and activities, both here domestically and around the world, send that message in a way that is counterproductive to trying to convince the millions of Muslims and others around the world to reject terrorism as an option. We're going to have to do both. We're going to have to both use force, and we're going to have to be exemplars of respect for human rights if we're ultimately going to put a stop to terrorism.
Now, I think a lot of folks might tend to think of the Amnesty International campaigns as targeted overseas, that is to say, college kids get together or other ordinary folks get together. They write their letters and they're writing on behalf of somebody who's in some cell in a country in Africa or Asia or somewhere like that. What about the domestic questions? I know there's some anxiety about the ramifications in terms of human rights of the Patriot Act.
Yes, indeed. Amnesty International and other organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union have been very active in raising concerns about domestic legislation such as the Patriot Act or a new piece of proposed legislation that goes by the acronym CLEAR, which would require the police to get involved in the tracking down of immigrant populations that may be in violation of visas. The problem with that, of course, being that would alienate from the police many of the people who the police most need to be sympathetic, to provide information, to provide assistance in tracking down real terrorists. But the Patriot Act, of course, is an example of, in our judgment, at least some elements of it, an example of overstepping and overstretching by the government. It's simply not necessary to fight terrorism by throwing away some of our most fundamental rights. It's always been the case that the government can go to a court if it has reason to suspect that someone is involved in a crime and get a subpoena from a court, get authorization from a court to look at that individual's personal records, to tap their phones, to demand further information. But under the Patriot Act, that process is virtually bypassed, and essentially on the word of the Attorney General alone, the most intimate records of almost any citizen can be accessed by the FBI and other kinds of authorities. We think that that's unnecessary and that's going too far. So, yes, those are some of the examples of domestic matters that concern us. But I should also mention that Amnesty has for many, many years been critical of other human rights violations in the United States, including perhaps preeminently our use of the death penalty, which we have opposed unequivocally, but also the growing use of electroshock weapons, for example, by our police and prison officials, the conditions under which prisoners are kept in some jurisdictions, and particularly the sexual violation of women prisoners. That's been of concern to the United States. The way in which the former Immigration and Naturalization Service treated the young people who came to this country as immigrants without parents or adult supervision and were often themselves then incarcerated and punished in circumstances that is not consistent with our ideals as Americans of how young people should be treated. These are just some examples of domestic issues that Amnesty tries to monitor.
Dr. Schultz, we're about out of time. I did want to end on something of an upbeat note because discussion of these sorts of issues can get sort of disheartening. When you go around to college campuses and church groups and what have you, and you speak to young people and the general public, what message of hope, what message of inspiration do you impart to them? Why, in the face of sort of what might be called compassion fatigue, what note of hope is out there?
Well, there are many, many notes of hope. We've touched upon some of them. The reality is that our world is in a far better place today in terms of human rights than it was in 1948 when Eleanor Roosevelt and others first created the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The very fact, for example, that more than 80 countries around the world have come together to create an international criminal court despite opposition by the United States, that is a tremendous development in the human rights field. It will mean that in future generations, those tyrants who decide to terrorize their own populations with torture and other kinds of crimes will be accountable to the international community. They will be put on trial, just as Slobodan Milosevic is on trial today and as many others have been convicted for crimes in Bosnia and in Rwanda. That in and of itself is a tremendously positive development. The fact that there are more and more people living under democracy today, the fact that the ethos and the rhetoric of human rights is being seized not just by governments, but far more importantly by indigenous groups around the world, that every one of our human rights activists here today is sister and brother, partner to indigenous human rights groups in virtually every country of the world, even in the most repressive countries. There are people who now know about human rights, who are utilizing human rights as a way to bring about their freedom. And finally, I would say that it's important for Americans to understand, for young people to understand, that the human rights movement is a worldwide movement, that as part of Amnesty International, you are part of a movement that is operating around the world. You are sisters and brothers to those who are trying to make a difference and indeed are making a difference every day in their own countries and in countries far, far away. The fact is that that kind of a network, that kind of international consciousness is something relatively new in human history, and we're on the ground floor building that up. People who are interested can get in touch with Amnesty through our website at Amnesty USA, all one word, amnestyusa.org, or call 1-800-AMNESTY and join us in this struggle.
Our guest today has been Dr. William Schultz, the Executive Director of Amnesty International USA. Dr. Schultz, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Will.
For Profiles, I'm Will Murphy. Thanks for listening.
The program you just heard was recorded in the studios of WFIU in November of 2003, Christina Kuzmich, producer. The recording engineer and editor was Michael Paskash, Luann Johnson, research assistant. Information about this and other programs can be obtained at 812-855-1357. Profiles programs can also be accessed through our website at wfiu.indiana.edu. For WFIU, thanks for listening. Don't give up the fight. Don't give it up. Don't give it up. Get up, stand up. Get up.
up for your life.